was very deep, where she fell very slowly. But she had plenty of time as she went down to wonder what was going to happen next.
Shuttle 5 approaching the anomaly.
I've lost them.
Spock, it's me.
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, the worst, the weirdest, the wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, always in a fight for the future.
Yes. And we are here this week to talk about the seventh episode in the second season of Star Trek Discovery, Light and Shadows.
Cam, this is officially the halfway mark for Star Trek Discovery, and beyond flashbacks, beyond voiceovers, I think it's enough talk. Now time for Spock. They've made us wait way too long.
They're like, we will Spock you.
You're just saying that because you love Bohemian Rhapsody, the movie.
So much. Yeah. So much.
I think we have to get into it right off the top here. I'll say this. I like the little that we saw of Ethan Peck, but I do think the introduction felt a little underwhelming to me.
Yeah. It wasn't number one underwhelming. And I refer to number one, the Rebecca Romijn appearance, yeah. Cameo, if you will. But it's tough to introduce Spock in a way that's interesting when he's in a addled state of mind, just repeating things over and over.
Like, he has no agency.
You're not getting a character. You're not getting like the Spock that we know, or even like a variation of the Spock personality. We are seeing a character basically under a spell.
And all we've had so far for buildup is how there's this big rift between Burnham and Spock.
Yeah.
And they can't even address that when he's introduced. So it is kind of naturally a letdown. I think what we can do is maybe comment on, I guess, the look of Spock and how much, I guess, Ethan Peck is, you know, trying to do his own variation of the character, even though we really haven't gotten to know the real Spock just yet.
I knew going in this was the Spock I was going to be introduced to. Because I just remember Alex Kurtzman doing interviews before I think season two even started, saying like, you know, the battle between faith and science has broken Spock's brain. And I was like, okay, so when I see this character, he's not going to be in a good state. And I think the first trailer, they showed him like unconscious on like a gurney or something, or I don't even remember it. It was just like, okay, so it's going to be a little while before we get the Spock that we might recognize.
So what do you think of what Ethan Peck is doing here, though?
I'm loving it, Tyler. I'm loving it. Solid gold Spock.
I think there's some stuff that we can kind of address here, though.
Sure.
Look, we've commented on some of the faults within the introduction here, which I think they really probably should have planned on doing something a little bit better.
Maybe a flashback?
I was going to say that. If only like a flashback to maybe like...
their final, or like the last time they saw each other or something.
Or what about like, say, look, it's a time travel episode, you know, like they could have had some sort of temporal tsunami sort of incident where it's maybe Spock dealing with Pike, you know, like the normal Spock in a uniform that we kind of know, like something, they could have done something a little bit more interesting than him in this kind of fugue state, like scratching at the walls.
In like a crypt?
Yeah. You know, a Katra crypt.
Yeah.
Where we got that exposition dump from one Sarek, who is just like, you came into the Katra crypt where we cannot do telepathic sensing at all. Well done, wife. It's just like,
right. We'll get to that stuff later.
Sure.
But yeah, it's really hard to gauge Spock at this point in time.
Engage?
But, I mean, he looks fine.
Yeah, look, he's got a cool look to him. Like, if he came out with, like, you know, like frosted tips...
Yeah.
You know, like, you'd be a little bit weirded out by the...
From the boy band craze?
Yeah. But you'd be like, okay, this is a different take, you know? But look, from what we're getting so far, I think Ethan Peck is on the right track, and I'm very much looking forward to, you know, maybe two episodes from now where I think we'll probably get more of the Spock that we do recognize.
Right. I think he has an interesting look. He doesn't really look like Spock, though. Like, I think Zach Quinto looked closer to Spock to me than Ethan Peck does.
I get that.
So it's going to be interesting to see if this, you know, version warms on me over the next few episodes.
It's the beard, man.
It's not just the beard. He has, like, more of, like, a boyish look, I feel like. And this is set after The Cage. And Spock in The Cage doesn't look that boyish.
In all fairness, I mean, Leonard Nimoy was not boyish at the time The Cage is filmed.
No. You know? And, like, people age differently back in 1966 or 64, I think they shot that, than they do nowadays.
They didn't use sunscreen.
So. I mean, So it makes sense, but it is just going to take some getting used to.
Okay, so we've talked about the introduction of Spock, but I wonder what this introduction adds to the story, though, because this is what we've been tracing for a long, long time, and I think we need to dive into it, especially with what's going on with Amanda and Sarek and Burnham all having a big a family reunion that's hasn't happened in probably, what, a decade at this point?
Right. Yeah, I want to get to that, because that's definitely the meat of this episode to talk about, but it was a little strange to me. This is our introduction to Spock, our reintroduction, and we had how many episodes of we're trying to find Spock's shuttle? We've picked up on the signal of where Spock is. And ultimately, where is he? Well, Amanda knows where he is.
Yeah.
It's like, what was the whole point of Discovery trying to track him down in all those episodes?
Well, let's track it, though, because Amanda didn't know where he was last time we saw her.
Correct.
So she figured it out.
And we know that it was a long time since Burnham had seen her mother, because she said off the top, it's been quite a while since I've seen my mother and father. So, and I was like, really? Has it?
That doesn't make sense to me.
I know.
Because
I guess the time gap?
Well, but it's weird because, like, I think every other episode has been established, like, one episode equals 1 week. Like, that's at least the implication that we've gotten. And it's been said explicitly as well.
Yeah.
So, look, let's say this Kaminar incident, there's a big gap. It took him a long time to get over to Kaminar from the previous episode.
Right.
Let's go with that.
Sure.
And so apparently Spock's gone. He somehow makes it to Vulcan. We don't know how. He seeks out his mother. He's in a state well enough to sidestep his father's efforts to track him down.
Yeah.
Goes to Amanda. Amanda puts him in the crypt. And, you know, for 2 days, he's having this kind of weird state of being.
What's strange about that, though, is that you would get the sense from Amanda's last appearance that she would have been the one to find him.
Which she didn't.
No.
He came to her.
Yes.
So it's
a little strange.
It also takes away agency from a character who, when we last saw her, looked as if she was a woman on a mission.
Yeah.
Which was to find her son, which was actually kind of cool. You're like, okay, I like what this character is doing. She seems way more active than we ever saw her in the original series and their movies.
Definitely,
so I'm like, okay, I'm digging this. But no.
Yeah.
So... Okay. So we've got a family reunion going now.
Yeah.
I actually thought it was a good scene. Like, despite, kind of the limited amount of stuff that we could get going with Spock, I do like the fact that we had all three of them together and there's conflict going on.
Yeah.
Because I think Amanda's been in the background for a lot of the few number of scenes that they've shared together. I'm thinking about, Will You Take My Hand, for example, when they're back on Paris.
Right, yeah.
So
and Leithy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do like the fact that we really get to see this family, just come apart a little bit at the seams, how Amanda's like, you don't really respect humanity. And Sark's like, well, if that's true, then I would have just married a Vulcan. So they kind of have this, back and forth that we've talked a lot about what the family dynamics must have been like in this household.
I love that Discovery and its writers seem to have picked up on what a strange family this is.
Yes.
Like, because we were talking... I think there's always been, they've always written about the dysfunction between Spock and Sarek, right? Like, that's all right from Journey to Babel onwards. But they've never really delved into Amanda's part in this. Like, we always got the sense she was always kind of the peacemaker between the two. But if you look at it from the point of view of human psychology and not just, like, kind of TV heightened writing, Amanda's life would be really, really brutal.
And I think that's... very interesting what they're doing with Burnham, though, and that I think Burnham, to her, is a very, very special person within her life. And like, just almost kind of an oasis of sorts.
Right. And I love that Discovery has picked up on these threads and realized that, like, the Amanda story is a really interesting story to be telling, because that is one heck of a life to have lived. And, in a 1960s TV show, they're not going to write... what is going on with, the mom character?
Yeah, I know.
They're just not going to in 1966. Whereas, like, now, they're, like, actually picking up on threads of canon elements of Star Trek and delving into it and adding interesting layers, which I'm all about. I love that.
And especially, I was thinking about it. Okay, like, when we first saw Sarek, This is way back in the original series. You can tell that Spock and Sark don't see eye to eye.
Except when it comes to putting down Amanda.
Yeah. That's very true. Interesting household, folks.
Yeah.
But, you know, look, if your dad threw you back to Section 31, like, right. I can understand why you have some issues with him. Like, what did anybody actually think was going to happen when you're sending him to Section 31? Why did Sark do that? Why not give him to, I don't know, like, the Vulcan High Command or, like, Starfleet Command? Why did it have to be Section 31? It seems so bizarre to me. I still love how it's a secret agency, and yet Amanda seems to know what Section 31 is.
Well, she's much more resourceful in this series.
Okay, very, very true. I just like to think about, like, Journey to Babel in the back of Amanda's head at that time. She's like, yeah, Section 31. I've had my dealings with them.
And she's hiding the black badge she's carrying.
Okay, we need to get back into Ash Tyler and the Pike stuff a little bit later on, but
I love the moment where she's having the confrontation with Sarek, and he, you know, spouts something back at her, and she's like, try again, husband. Mm. And I was like, hardcore. It's like Amanda laying down the law. Like,
that's not the first time she's probably dropped that bomb.
Definitely not. But no. I like that we're seeing this character do this because, you know, in the 60s, they wrote it as more of a passive character.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that, like, we're seeing an Amanda who has some fire to her and is actually like, look, you would get so, especially a human, I don't care whether you're, you know, you're Amanda or me, I would be annoyed as hell dealing with Vulcans day in, day out because, you know, they wouldn't see eye to eye with you. And with an issue like this, especially where it's her child, you'd be like, come on, Sarek. Like, get your head out of here. You know? And I love that she calls him out. And, like, she's definitely, you know, the tougher one in that situation. I like it. I think it's great.
So we find ourselves on Captain Leland's ship, you know?
Yeah.
Sarek knows Leland by name. Interesting. What do you think of Georgiou's motivations here? Why does Georgiou care at all about, I guess, let's think about it. A, the fate of Spock, and then B, Leland's connections, apparent connections to Burnham's past with regards to him being responsible for the death of her biological parents.
Yeah.
I just keep wondering back, like, is this because Georgiou genuinely cares, or does she have some sort of ancillary motive that will, you know, bring her own wishes to fruition?
I actually think Georgiou does care about Burnham.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Burnham cares that much about Georgiou, but no. I think Georgiou has this maybe twisted fondness for Burnham. Like, she's kind of like this, you know, angel on her shoulder. That's more of like
a red angel.
A red angel. No, more like, I guess, just like someone who's always kind of looking out for her from the shadows.
Yeah.
For her own reasons that are definitely driven by her own warped psychology. But I'm kind of growing into the idea of this Georgiou who's here to help Burnham, but Burnham doesn't really want the help. Yes. I think it's actually a fun dynamic. It's something we've never really had on Star Trek, unless you point to things like Q and Picard, where Q does sometimes want Picard to figure out the right answers to things.
I think that's like a good comparison, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I did say, like, we've said early on, like, Discovery needed to have its, like, you know, Q-type character who could show up and get these really interesting insights into a character, like, and Burnham, because she's the protagonist most likely. You know, you had Q on Next Gen, and we thought at first it might be Harry Mudd playing that role, because, you know, when you cast Rainn Wilson, you're like, well, this is going to be a major character.
Meanwhile, halfway through the season, we haven't seen him.
We haven't. Yeah. But
minus the short trek.
It does feel like Georgiou is kind of filling that role in a different way. It's a serialized way where the character doesn't just pop up in special episodes, but is there kind of more for the journey. Look, but I think it's an interesting idea.
I've never been a huge fan of kind of the Georgiou character and what she represents, but if she's bringing something out of our other characters, I do appreciate that. And I think, like, Michelle Yeoh, like, you heard
Michelle Yeoh's having a really good year.
Yeah, I was laughing when, you know, Burnham was like, did you murder your own mother? And Georgiou's like, it's all a blur. Like, wow, okay. You know, but
she gets great dialogue. She might get the best dialogue of any character on the show.
Having fun with her,
yeah.
You know, it doesn't have to be super serious all the time. Unlike one Ash Tyler, it's like, yeah. Is there a less fun character on Discovery than Ash Tyler?
Does he have the okay? So I do the Arnold Schwarzenegger podcast with my friend Tony
Arnie Geddon.
We did an episode on Terminator 3, and we were debating whether John Connor is the least fun role in, like, the Terminator franchise to ever play, because you're just, like, grim and put upon and just, you know, tormented. And that's kind of what Ash Tyler is. He's this character who's just buried in torment, and he's always trying to find a place and never able to, and never trying to earn respect from people. It's just like, you don't get to play a lot of fun stuff with that character.
What's the most fun we've ever seen him? And I don't mean like the best, because we've talked about that, say, Volk sure. confrontation.
Yeah, he's had great moments in terms of dramatic yeah, performance. But
have we really seen him have fun at all? Or at least that, do
there's
some
that gif
fun
of
stuff.
Him drinking from the glass with the straw.
Oh, that's pretty funny.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm guessing it's well, it would probably be in the party scene from Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad.
Yeah.
When he's kind of teasing Burnham a bit about flirting.
Okay.
You know, that sort of thing.
I think that's a great showcase for one Tyler. So I think the lesson is that we keep going back to is like Discovery, like you work way best, not when you're being super, super serious, but like yeah. when you're having fun with the characters here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So look, Giorgio's helping out Spock for some reason. Yeah. We'll have to see how that plays out. But
what do you think of Section 31 being tied potentially to the death of Burnham's parents?
I guess it makes sense, though, and if yeah. like there's like Klingon aggression going on, and maybe, you know, I can totally imagine 20, 25 years ago, Section 31 being involved with whatever Klingon shenanigans are happening sure. between those two within that Cold War.
I just hope it's not some sort of destiny narrative where it's something like, you know, Burnham's father was making breakthroughs in something or other, and Section 31 arranged to have him killed by Klingons yeah. or something, where it's kind of like, well, it's a good thing fate put Burnham in the place she is now to have all this, you know, come together. That sort of stuff, you're like, oh, like I kind of like the idea more of Star Trek. It's like people who work really hard and go to school, and then, you know, the adventures open up to them through their experiences, as opposed to, like, my life is on a track of destiny.
You don't want the Peter Parker origin story from The Amazing Spider-Man starring Andrew Garfield.
Exactly. Yeah. That one stunk.
It really did.
In fact, I don't even remember it. I don't know what you're talking about, Tyler. There was no Amazing Spider-Man movies.
Remember, like, Campbell's... No, but, like, it had something to do with Campbell Scott on yeah. an airplane.
Yeah, him and his wife. They were on... Yeah.
It's like, okay.
And they had, like, that secret underground railroad car. Like... Those movies were, like, a hallucination.
Yeah. But,
But, yeah, like, that's the sort of storytelling... I think it works in certain things, like especially in like fantasy stories, things like that. I'm totally down for like a destiny narrative, but in Star Trek, I don't know that it's that interesting. And I think it's more just intriguing storytelling wise when you have these characters who aren't on this sort of track having to be put in situations that they don't feel like they've been trained for and having to like wrap their heads around them.
Yeah.
That's more interesting. Like Picard being made the like ambassador to humanity by Q. Picard's life was not on some sort of destiny track for this moment.
Okay, well, speaking of people that really clearly have not been trained for their positions, what do you think of Ash Tyler throwing his black badge at Pike while he's sitting in the chair?
Ash Tyler in this episode is amazing.
Like, when he literally is introduced in the episode by demanding to know the location yeah. of his ex.
It's like, where's Burnham?
It's like, okay.
You and I both looked at each other when he said that. It was like...
Yeah.
I don't know if it was a bit of a clunky line delivery or what, but it sounded weird.
It really did. It sounded kind of, you know, the toxic masculinity come to life.
It didn't sound like a Section 31 operative having, like, a question that they want to know. It's yeah, like...
It wasn't like, hey, where's Burnham?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was more like, where's Burnham? It was, like, kind of pouty.
All right, so,
and like, I do love that, like, Pike seems to really enjoy trolling Tyler. Like, that has been a lot of joy for me in these two episodes.
Yeah.
I'm hoping they don't get rid of that because it seems like they have kind of this mutual respect at the end. I'm like, oh, that's not what I want.
I
want,
think they
like,
are getting rid of it, though.
I know. I want Pike butting heads. And then when that respect started, I'm like, oh, no. Oh, no. Pike's clearing the way to bring Tyler back onto the ship at some point.
Well, let's talk about their dynamic through yeah. this episode. And one thing that I constantly keep trying to ask myself, when Discovery has a less focused episode, which this was, because there's two... different stories being told side by side.
There
and
were.
So what I was trying to like make the connection between is, and this is far more of a thematic connection, but you think about the state of Spock's mind right now and kind of the state of that temporal rift where it's all just mixed up and jumbled there.
Right.
So I was looking at kind of links between that, but what are you grasping onto with regards to kind of the parallel stories being told?
Well, there's definitely something too about like respectful relationships, because you have Sarek and Amanda like coming to heads, and you also have Ash Tyler and Pike, and like obviously, you know, it's family versus, you know, crew, but the crew is kind of a family, so it's kind of like these not seeing respect from one another and trying to kind of find a common ground there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it's underlined in a way that's particularly rich. It doesn't come together in a way where I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
Now, that's the great message of the episode. But there's, I think, similar ideas there.
Well, so this is kind of what confused me going into this one, because I think we all just assumed this would be the episode where, you know, Michael goes back to Vulcan.
Sure.
And then we see that there's, like, these time shadows. Everything sounds cooler when you add time in front of it, Cam. But you see these time shadows of, say, Pike, and you're like, oh, you know, it's a halfway point of the season. That's where we got magic to make the Sanus Man go mad last year. I'm like, maybe they're going to do another time travel episode. I don't know if this one played that much with the time travel tropes and did it.
Not really. It was.
I don't know if they did anything super interesting with it.
I think the most interesting thing was where you had the moment where Pike saw the, you know, the time moment replayed of, like, him pointing the phaser and shooting at Ash Tyler.
But that was all they really did.
I know, but I was hoping
it.
That was going to build into, like, a real paranoia scenario.
But it didn't.
It didn't. Yeah. No, I thought that was actually kind of a missed opportunity.
So I guess what I'm grabbing onto is something a little bit more tangible, though, in that I think we are getting hints with regards to Calypso, the short track, with regards to the time travel questions here. Because, of course, they send that probe out. It goes 500 years in the future, and then it comes back as if it visited Zion in the Matrix. You know, it looked like one of those Matrix probes.
I was like, is this a Borg thing?
I don't think it's a Borg thing.
You don't think so?
No, not at all.
The fact it was, like, purging all the information from the computers, I was like, oh.
I don't for an instance believe it has to do with
the
Borg.
Not.
I really hope not.
I just remember Alex Kurtzman talking about when he was doing press for the movies. He's like, I can't wait to do a Borg movie.
Yeah, but,
and
you know,
I was like, oh.
Let's just say this. I would hope they don't go down that path, because I think as much as we're probably not huge fans of Endgame, I think what they wanted to do is give some finality to the Borg not necessarily being dealt a death blow, but saying, you know what, they're just going to be a much weaker entity moving forward.
Right.
So if we come back and we have to have a big storyline that involves the Borg somehow being tied to the Red Angels, like, it means that the Borg are going to have to become threatening again. And Voyager made it very clear that they're not a threatening species anymore.
Right, right.
So it takes away a little bit from the legacy of Voyager. So that's why I'm very reluctant for them to explore a future Borg. I could wrap my head more around it if we somehow, you know, who knows the explanation, but we somehow encountered, you know, the 23rd century version of the Borg.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Borg are very tempting. But then I also say, like, they wouldn't really throw the Borg into a arc that's also featuring Section 31 and the crew of the Enterprise and all that sort of stuff. It would get so busy.
Wait, are you saying that Discovery doesn't like to get busy? Yeah.
Well, that's very true.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, that did kind of go through my head. But at the same time, I mean, maybe we're going to find out the origin of V'ger.
Again, I don't think so. I really don't think so.
Why not, Tyler? I want my V'ger origin.
I just don't know if the will is there. But so what we are finding and building, and I think the opening monologue, and Cam, we have been getting a lot of monologues the last couple episodes, but the opening monologue, I think, connected a lot of dots and made it very explicit that this is like a time travel storyline moving forward with a mechanized suit, time suit. Because everything sounds cooler if you add time to it.
Right.
So what do you think about the idea that maybe the arc that we're looking at is kind of a time travel-centric sort of arc this season?
I mean,
I think there are hints of it already with the Calypso short track.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know? Big time.
So they had been, like, kind of signaling it.
Yes. I mean, here's the thing. Star Trek's done many time travel stories. Some are good. Some are bad. And we actually did an episode on time travel stories. I'll post a link to that in the show notes. But if it's a story involving time travel that's really interesting and has something to say, I'm 100% on board and I will not complain. But it's becoming a bit of a curiosity to me whether Discovery is using time travel to retcon things. And, like, you know, we complained about that a couple weeks ago where, like, the episode just seemed to be retconning everything. And it's like, are these Red Angels allowing them to...
Which episode specifically? Obel for Charon when we're...
Nope, the one after that.
Saints of Imperfection.
Yeah, Saints of Imperfection. Yeah. It was that episode where, like, they were retconning multiple elements of the show from the previous season.
Bringing
back Culber and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. Right. There was a few things. But, like, I'm just a little concerned that they're using time travel to basically address the problems people had with the first season to get it closer to a, like, recognizable Star Trek canon.
The other thing that concerns me, though, is time travel just doesn't usually make sense. You know, it's oftentimes just kind of you can point out a lot of holes within a lot of stories, and it makes it a little aggravating at times.
But I love in, like, I think it was Voyager where they had the episode where, like, the temporal agents come.
Yeah.
And, like, they're acknowledging that it doesn't even make sense. Like, they're like, oh, time travel again. Like, you know, it's actually, like, playing up the idea that it's so complicated that no one wants to deal with it.
Yeah.
Like,
or no, wait, was that Trials and Tribulations from Deep Space Nine?
Maybe it was Trials and Tribulations. Yeah. But they were, like, playing up the fact that, like, time travel is so complicated that, like, it's just a headache. And, you know, I think even Janeway acknowledged, like, oh, no, time travel.
Yeah.
And, like, I like the idea that it is so complicated. And, you know, the temporal police stuff was fun. But we saw, like, temporal stuff in Enterprise was disaster.
It really was.
And so it is a fine line to walk. If they sat down before season two Discovery and wrote out one hell of a, you know, breakdown of a time travel story that is going to pay off at the end, I will be happy as can be. If it works and it's compelling, fantastic. I love City on the Edge of Forever. That's a time travel story. And so if they can do something, you know, that's really cool and memorable, great. But if it does feel like they're doing it just to do away with elements that maybe they weren't happy with or get things closer to a recognizable, you know, closer to TOS era Star Trek, it's like,
I know.
Well, it bothers me in that sense because it's like they felt they couldn't get there organically. But you had to involve outside forces to make the show closer to established canon.
But I just don't think that's where they're going, though.
I hope not.
Because just think about the logistics. So, like, does that mean that it's going to, the rest of the series, for however long it runs, it's going to have elements of this time travel stuff just so that by the series finale, you can say, oh, look at all the technology and the aesthetics. It's back to what we all recognize. I think they want to have this time travel arc wrapped up by the end of the season.
I hope so.
I don't think that's necessarily where we're going with this, but
it's a concern when they start, because Discovery in the past has been very guilty of introducing these plot mechanics to basically shift the direction of the show in very clumsy ways.
Yeah.
And so I guess I'm a little on the lookout at this point with Discovery, because we've had a couple episodes where they've done that, and I'm like, oh, please don't do that anymore. You're better than this, Discovery.
What you said earlier, though, with regards to Enterprise and the time travel stuff there, that they spent three seasons, like, touching upon, and then they finally wrapped it up in the premiere of season four.
Yeah.
I'm like, do we really need to go back to some sort of battle for the future? Like, that's what they're talking about here.
We're always fighting for the future, Tyler.
I know. So I'm just kind of like, we've kind of been there, done that. I want to see something new. I think maybe it could be interesting if this whole idea of, you know, like, science versus faith, it comes down to a higher being simply having the ability to go back in time and change events. Or maybe the Red Angels are just rectifying events that should not have taken place because of another element that they're fighting against. You know, maybe that's kind of what it comes down to. So I'll hold off judgment until we actually see it come out. We're halfway through the season, though. Where do you think we are right now at the halfway mark for Star Trek Discovery?
In what sense?
I'll spell out, like, my answer here then.
Yeah.
I still feel as if the show is still kind of, like, revving up its engine. I don't think it's gone into full throttle at this point. And I think there's been some highlights. I really liked last week's episode. I really liked New Eden.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, like, I think we're still waiting for it to really kick in. An episode like this, which I thought was perfectly fine. It didn't grip me. It wasn't super exciting. There were no emotional gut punches that maybe I was hoping for. Like, maybe we got, like, last episode or in a Noble for Charon.
Right. This episode to me felt, not in terms of quality, but in terms of its kind of the role it played in what feels like the unfolding of the story, it felt a little bit to me like a CV Packham Parabellum, where it's an episode that's putting the pieces down for what's going to follow into something that's a little more, you know, spectacular. In that case, you had Into the Forest I Go, which was great. And this episode feels like it's building to something, hopefully in the next episode or two, that's really cool. But, I'm not going to say that this was a great episode, because there's been a few others I've liked quite a lot. This one, to me, though, I mean, I don't know if it's... We aren't exactly 100% sure on the shift in showrunners, where exactly that fell. But from everything I've been able to glean online, we are now in the era post the original two showrunners, Gretchen Berg and, Aaron...
Harberts.
Harberts, yeah. And to me, this episode, you know, you said off the top, it was like kind of a little bit too bouncing around stories that maybe don't necessarily feel that coherent as a whole. But to me, these two felt like very specific stories. Like, whereas some of the episodes in the first half of Discovery, like Saints of Imperfection or the Klingon story, which title I'm totally blanking on in the moment. I believe it had the word light in it.
Was it Point of Light?
I think it was Point of Light, yeah. Those ones just felt so scattershot and just bouncing all around like crazy. This episode felt very disciplined in the sense you had your A story and your B story. They both unfolded with an interesting beginning, middle, and end. They didn't necessarily, you know, lead to huge fireworks like you were saying, but they felt confident. And, like, there was a couple episodes this season that felt really, really unconfident to me.
I'll say this. I think that this was a perfectly competent episode. It, you know,
like, and it had some, like, genuinely great moments, like the family drama with Sarek and Amanda. I thought, you know, some of the Burnham and Giorgio stuff was really fantastic. Like,
Tilly,
it had moments.
Tilly was great in this
Tilly
one, too.
Was great. Like, it felt like, yeah, maybe it wasn't the greatest time vortex or whatever plot that Star Trek's ever come up with, but it felt like it was done reasonably well and had good character writing throughout. So I have a hard time really getting annoyed about this episode, even if I don't like it as much as, like, Obol for Charon or whatever.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about, like, maybe the cliffhanger. And there's other things I do want to address.
Yeah,
in this
for
one,
sure.
But the cliffhanger...
I want to talk about Leland in depth.
But for me, I mean, I love the Talos IV shout-out that we
Tyler,
got.
Oh, Tyler, I was so excited.
Does this work as a cliffhanger for all those fans that don't get the reference, though?
No.
Yeah. But for those fans that may not have been super familiar with an episode of Star Trek, like The Cage.
The Menagerie.
Talos IV is where those super iconic aliens with the pulsating giant brains live, and they have that menagerie of different aliens that they collect. And we find that Pike, his ultimate fate is willingly being kind of trapped in like a dreamscape of sorts.
Kind of like the Happy Machine. Yeah,
yeah, I like that. Yeah. And so what we do know is, like, Starfleet is forbidden under the death penalty from traveling there.
That's so crazy. Do you think they would ever say that in, like, the Picard era? Death penalty for Starfleet members who go to this planet.
Yeah, which is hilarious. But look.
Picard's, like, sending his crew members to death for visiting Talos.
He's the executioner. Yeah,
beaming them into space.
Sorry, but it's against the rules. So, but with regards to this one, though, I am excited because we did, I forget if it was a video or if it was just a short segment on one of the podcasts, but we talked about aliens that we want to see coming up in Star Trek Discovery. This is before it premiered, and we did talk about the Talosians.
We talked about the Talosians really early. I think we did, like, episode 4 of this podcast or something. We did an episode called Underexplored Aliens or something like that, where we definitely referenced the Talosians. Like, I've wanted to see Talosians for a long time, but it never seemed like there was a good way to bring them back, because obviously there's a death penalty around Talos.
Yeah, so it's interesting because I think in season 1, our feelings like, yeah, we'll never see the Talosians. But then, like, when we found out that it looked like Pike was going to be coming up in season 2, I remember between seasons, I think you and I went back and forth. We're like, well, if there's any excuse to bring them on, this would be it. But I like how this is actually tying more to the Spock storyline, not the Pike storyline.
Yeah, because we don't really know anything about Spock and Talos.
Yeah.
He was down there laughing at flowers, you know, like, Spock in the cage is not a main role in that story, so I'm actually really interested to see what he's going to bring there, and
I cannot wait to see what the Talosians look.
Oh, I can't wait. Next week can't come fast enough, but do you think the Talosians are going to be the ones that cure Spock's mindset?
Yeah, makes sense.
It does.
But, is Burnham going to have to be stuck in, like, one of their, like, cells for at least half the episode? I want that Gorilla Man to, like, make an appearance, too.
Right.
Like, that would be great to see. There are some pretty cool-looking aliens, you know, for the pilot for Star Trek.
So Vina would be there at this point, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Cam.
Do we get a Vina, like, second appearance?
She is perhaps, like, one of the most iconic aliens, if only for the fact that she gets that appearance in the end credits. You know, every episode, there's that, like, iconic image of her, right?
Yeah.
So,
is she an alien, though? She's human, isn't she?
Is she?
Well, I don't know.
I thought she was supposed to be Orion.
No, she is in Pike's fantasy.
Yeah.
But Vina is, like, a blonde woman.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So I don't know if she's human or if she's in, like, you know, off-world or somewhere, but whatever the
case.
It's
always very confusing because, like, half the aliens that we meet look exactly like
humans.
Exactly,
yes.
So,
sometimes it's tough to gauge, especially in the pilot, where I think they were playing down the alien attributes quite a bit.
Yeah.
But
she has a tail.
But, yeah, like, I'm just excited to see what that looks like. That's fantastic. I mean, you're right, though. for someone who is just, maybe this is their first Star Trek series, this falls flat as can be. Flatter than a pancake.
So do you think that, you know, these newbies will be coming in, looking at the Talosians, do you think they'll get how cool it is? Or do you think that the creators are capable of making them cool regardless of our prior connections to them for fans like us?
I think they have to. Yeah. I think they have to, if they're going to do this and we're going to see Talosians, they have to do it in a way that it works for someone who's never watched the original series, because the Talosians have a certain kitschy 60s look. Yeah. I love them. But, you know, you trot them out now with that same makeup in a gray, you know, like, it's like a sleeping gown. You know, it's going
to
look...
I wear that to work.
It's like an old-fashioned, like, Mr. Burns, like, sleeping gown.
Yeah. Yeah, like,
but, yeah, they're going to have to do a bit of redesign. I mean, they've done that with all the aliens so far to make them all look, I think, pretty cool. There's been, the Klingons we can go back and forth on. But I think other than that, they've been pretty spot on with the aliens.
My biggest worry is they're going to pull a Spock, and they'll get to Talos, and they'll be like, it looks like the Talosians all just left right at the last moment. We can't see any of them.
They can't do that to me.
They messed around with us for 7 episodes with Spock. Yeah. So that's, I don't know.
Do you think they're going to have a Pike and Vina reunion?
Maybe.
Oh,
look, I think they could plant a lot of seeds for, you know, what we ultimately find out about his fate in the menagerie.
Yeah, yeah.
So I kind of dig kind of that idea there.
Me too. I am definitely 100% in for next week.
Does he ride a horse?
Only in my fantasies.
Okay.
On the beach.
With his shirt buttoned down. Yeah. All right.
Yes.
Other stuff that I want to talk about, though, and this is something more of concern.
Mm-hmm.
Culper. What's going on with that character and Stamets's relationship to his now returned husband, who obviously probably has some PTSD, some psychological trauma to deal with here?
Culber's hanging out with Jet Reno.
I apparently, you know. But yeah. The other issue, though, is that, you know, they do acknowledge, you know, that Pike says, Tyler, you killed somebody on this ship. He's like, yep. It's like, okay, well, yeah. I guess they are acknowledging it. How come we haven't had, like, a real scene between, you know, Tyler and his victim at this point? Not that I think Culber is itching to meet the man cracked his neck, but they have to address this, though, and it's just kind of weird. And look, I think the last two episodes have been pretty busy.
Yes.
But it is still kind of weird that they haven't quite timed it right, and we haven't had this addressed at all.
This is where serialization isn't your friend.
Yeah.
Because if you do this in episodic Star Trek, you can, like, leave a couple episodes where you have this moment where these two characters get together and actually talk about this sort of thing. You know, you'd wait until the next character-specific episode that actually deserved this sort of stuff. But in a serialized show, it's really weird for characters to just disappear in a week. I'm trying to think of other shows I watch that are serialized that do this discovery thing where characters literally vanish this often. You may have one where they only pop in for a scene or two.
Yeah.
But, like, Culber vanished in this episode. Jet Reno vanished for a period of time. And I get it. She's not a regular cast member. But she's introduced playing a major role in one episode and then vanishes where they finish solving the problem of the first episode.
Yeah.
It's weird.
I agree with that. But the problem is, I think the writers know that one of Discovery's faults is that it can get a little too busy.
Yeah.
And if they're trying to mitigate against that, I can't really fault them, especially if you and I often criticize them for doing that.
Yeah,
so,
I'm sure they're really listening to us.
Well.
They care so much.
But, you know, but what I'm getting at, though, it's something that we pick up on, which I think the writers must pick up on as well.
Yeah. I think you're right.
Okay.
But I agree. No, I would like to see an Ash Tyler Culber scene sooner rather than later.
Yeah. Arium. Mm. They gave her
something to do.
And I just, look, it's such kind of a
I feel
a
so
side...
bad for the actress from season one, who had to leave for some reason.
I think it was like makeup, like she's allergic
that's
to the makeup.
Theory. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, gets replaced. And now Arium finally gets things to do.
But, you know, I think she turned into a fan favorite last season just by how badass looking she looked.
Yeah.
And so now she's finally getting stuff to do. We saw that a few episodes ago. And we are now, you know, it's a bit of a sci-fi cliche in which, you know, kind of the computer seizes control of a part of the ship through this code.
I mean, this has happened to Data a few times.
Yes. Yeah. I could totally buy into it, but I think there's potential for them to be doing some cool stuff with this, especially I think all it really means is we're going to be seeing more Arium at least the next episode or two.
I do have questions, though, whether we, I don't know, see a lot out of Arium. Because Arium's not a character, really, at this point in time. And I have a hard time believing they're going to be giving Arium a showcase.
I know.
Versus,
I know.
Like, she's going to just cause some sort of problem that they have to solve.
So the thing that would disappoint me is if we find out, you know, the crew's been, you know, slightly sabotaged for, like, two episodes.
Sabotaged.
I thank you. That's that's really ouch. But, and then we I don't know, it's a whodunit, and then at the very last minute, Arium gets one line as they discover it was her, and she says, "Not my fault." You know, like, that would be kind of a bummer. Like, I think there's potential for them to do a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah. What do you think the lights that Arium was seeing were?
I think
saw,
that,
like, the, you know, a couple of lights she was looking at.
That was kind of the download trigger for her. Like, mm-hmm. That is what has essentially taken over, the mechanism for taking over her, I guess, consciousness or subconsciousness at this point. This will be influencing her moving forward.
Are we going to get the Arium version of masks?
Aztec
gods from space taking over Arium.
I can only hope that she gets the showcase that Brent Spiner got in that one there. So, yes. Cam, any final thoughts on this one before we look? Because there's lots of news to dive into, and there's also some stuff that we want to talk about with our own podcast.
I wasn't being facetious earlier. I actually want to talk about Leland.
Okay.
Because, you know, Leland was introduced here as someone who could help Spock. And I actually really liked Leland as a character who actually cared.
Did you buy it, though?
I did in the moment. Oh, like, okay. I was like, you know what? I kind of like this. I was in my head not really able to make sense of, like, what the role of Section 31 is in this world where apparently they're just, like, do-gooders who want to help out.
And they all have ships. And
yeah. I'm like, that's kind of strange. I don't really get it. But at the same time, I was like, I felt like the actor was doing, like, a good job. Like, he seemed charismatic. And it was the first time he seemed like a character I would actually want to watch on a TV show. Because, you know, we don't know if this Section 31 show, when it's going to happen or whatever. We know that Michelle Yeoh is attached. We don't know if Leland is a character who's going to be on it. But I have to only assume at this point he will, because he's the only other characters I've really got to attach onto this show. So I want to see something out of this character that I could maybe see that maybe there could be more room to grow this character.
So the problem is, like, the one moment that we get some sort of nuance out of him,
yes,
we find out that, well, at least we have Giorgio saying that it's all fake.
Yes.
So then it's kind of tough for us to really invest in this character, and that's where I am right now.
I also am having issues with Leland.
Also, Leland's going to be dead by the end of the season.
You think so?
Yeah.
You think Giorgio's going to take him out?
It has to be something along those
vaporized
lines. Yeah. Or don't you miss the days of Star Trek where the fight choreography just consisted of two-handed punches a la arena? Now we're getting just, like, ninjutsu moves like from both the characters here.
I like the point of view shot of Giorgio's head, like, smacking through the glass.
That was awesome.
That was great. I thought that was fantastic.
Not something we ever would have seen in, like, season 3 of Next Generation or anything like that.
Yeah, it actually reminded me of the scene in season 1 where Laurel and Cornwell staged the fight in the hallway in front of Cole.
Oh, yeah.
Similar situation where it's like, make this look convincing.
So, do you know, if we ever got a POV shot, I would have wanted a camera attached to the barrel that fell on Worf in Ethics.
Oh, my God. Like, that would... Get out of my head. But something has been bothering me the last couple weeks, and that is Leland kept referring to control.
Yeah.
And it was like, there's something in my head kept going off, like, this is goofy. Why is this bothering me? Why? Like, because it's an innocuous word. I don't know what control is. It's not explained. But I'm like, something's bothering me about this.
Can I guess what it is? Or would I potentially be spoiling
what
it?
What do you think it is?
A reference to Get Smart?
Yes. Finally, tonight, it went through my head. I was like, that's what it is. It's like Maxwell Smart, and I apologize to all the young, really young people out there who have no idea what Get Smart is, but it was a spoof show created by Mel Brooks in the 60s with Don Adams?
Don Adams,
yeah. And it was kind of a James Bond kind of spoof, Man from U.N.C.L.E. type deal.
Yeah.
And he worked for a spy agency called Control. And it was like a goofy, you know, like, spoof TV show. But they always played Control as, like, a complete joke. Yeah. And now you have Leland saying very seriously, this isn't going to go well with Control. This was a poor word choice for old people, myself.
For old people, or else people that came into this franchise via Steve Carell and Anne Hathaway.
Does anyone remember that movie? It wasn't that bad. Like, I thought it was okay, but
it didn't really make much money, did it?
I don't think it was that big a hit. No.
And it's not really talked about anymore.
Definitely not.
Yeah. So
it did not relaunch Get Smart as a pop culture phenomenon.
What was the enemies were Chaos, right?
Yeah.
Is Chaos and Control.
Right.
And there was a reference to Chaos in this episode, was there not?
Oh, thank you for bringing that up. That family was really into Alice in Wonderland.
Yes. What would be the equivalent in your family, though? I know what it is for my family.
What is it with your family?
Growing up, whenever we'd go to like the family cabin, my mom would always grab a Anne of Green Gables book, and she would read it to us throughout the week. And so for the years we were going up to this family cabin, when my sister and I were, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, we'd always get Anne of Green Gables in our family.
Okay, I think for our family, it was the Ramona novels. Like, was it Beverly Cleary? She wrote, like, the Beezus and Ramona stories, and then there was the Henry Huggins stories. That is what we would get a lot as kids. But that was a series. They weren't literally reading me the same book over and over, which is apparently what Amanda did.
Yeah, no wonder why Spock is having these issues right now.
Yeah, I like the kind of added backstory of Spock having, like, a learning disability that she was helping him through with this book.
Yeah.
It gives Amanda, again, a little more input into Spock's upbringing, which had always kind of been fudged around on the show. They never really talked about it.
I was trying to figure out why they were so insensitive to his learning disability, but what I'm trying to gather here is though it's a human...
It was like a human-born
But the one, name of it was a Vulcan word, right?
Yes, but it's basically dyslexia.
Okay.
So I'm a little confused about that.
So the issue is that it's just so uncommon in Vulcan that they don't even want to bother dealing with it?
I guess so.
Okay. It just seemed rather insensitive for such an enlightened species.
Maybe it's a issue that only shows up in half Vulcan, half human children?
Which probably not that many.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe that's what it is. I don't know. Maybe we'll get more backstory on Vulcan learning disabilities in the episodes to come.
Okay. But yeah, sure.
But no, like...
All addressed with... complete sensitivity.
Of course.
Yes.
Yes. But I like the fact that Amanda had like an active role in this, in actually helping Spock in a way that a human had to. When you watch the original series or the other Spock stuff, it always seems like he's pretty much all Vulcan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he kind of purged all the human stuff, and Amanda's just like, hey, remember me? He's like, yes, mother. And you're like, poor Amanda.
Yeah.
But I like the sense that she was actually using her own human abilities to help him in a way that the Vulcans couldn't.
Yeah.
So I think that's great. But the reading Alice in Wonderland over and over again, like, this is really strange because they have brought this up so many times on Discovery now. This Alice in Wonderland thread is getting very bizarre. It seems to be the only influence, the only cultural or pop culture influence in Burnham's entire life. And apparently now Spock's.
Look, we'll find out next episode that they're really into, you know, Johnny Coltrane as well. You know, like, it's got to be like 20th century jazz music.
Sure.
So, one last thing for me. I thought that the shot of Vulcan looked fantastic as they were flying, as Burnham was flying in.
The other it looked thing different. Like, Vulcan always kind of looks the same in a lot of the other series.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that they were, you know, Discovery's done some fair redesigning on a lot of the elements of Star Trek. And I think it had a good look. And I love the Sarek's house or whatever. It looked amazing.
Yeah, well, like, we were introduced to it in the premiere in Brother, and we saw the exterior for the first time, and I think they're trying to establish why when we were in that premiere episode, we'd look out and see all these, like, wondrous trees on a desert planet.
Right.
And it was funny because we actually just saw, like, rain coming down. I just wonder if they're in some sort of kind of, like, rainy side of a mountain, and that's why there's some sort of, like, signs of vegetation, although those are all dead leaves on those trees. So
Vulcan can't be all desert, right?
It could be.
An entire planet?
Sure.
It's like Tatooine.
Have you not seen an episode of Star Trek where apparently every single planet out there is all desert? You know?
That's true.
So, look, the other thing is maybe Sark is just bringing a lot of trees from Earth. And like, also, I don't really understand this whole diplomatic immunity. Like, so...
Diplomatic immunity. Well, okay. Lethal Weapon 2 for the win.
So, like, Sark is... Yes. Okay, I always understood him as the Vulcan ambassador to the Federation. And so Amanda is saying that while she's on planet Vulcan, she can invoke diplomatic immunity.
Voca.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
To prevent extradition of Spock back to the Federation, despite the fact that Vulcan is a member of the Federation. I didn't really understand any of this. Like, to me, like, I always thought of you know, the Federation is a little bit tighter than, say, the EU, but not quite as tight as the United States, sure. You know, when it comes to, like, these federal bodies.
Sure.
So this makes it seem more like the UN.
Well,
it just kind of confuses me.
It felt to me more like Enterprise-era Vulcans, yeah, where it's like they're members of the Federation, but they got their own stuff going on away from the eyes of the Federation. So I don't really know.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't really get it.
we'll leave this episode off on our diplomatic immunity discussion here. But
and I think we also have to have our weekly Pike Watch and just talk about Anson Mount.
Sure.
But what did you think of this thread that they – this basically character revelation we come to at the end of this episode where, you know, he's piloted this shuttle. He used to be like an experimental pilot. And he says, you know, that he admits that he's been taking these missions because of guilt over the Klingon War. I don't know that this is really tracked that well. I like that they have made that an element to the character, and he did bring that up earlier in the season, but it's not something I really felt episode to episode.
I think the problem is they did bring it up once in the beginning of the season.
It was like episode one or two.
Yeah. And then they have not really touched on it since then. So I think it feels a little false to me when we have Tyler accusing him of that, and then by the end of it, Pike admits, yeah, that's what it is. Even though Pike seems to be right. Like, that seemed to be the right decision, though. That,
yes.
Like, to, like, burn off gas to create signals for them to find this ship.
Which Ash Tyler admitted as well.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like Pike has really, like, gone into these, like, situations in a way that felt like cavalier or...
He did want to blast a hole in that dying organic alien in outer space.
That's true.
So maybe that's it. I don't know.
I guess, but it doesn't feel to me like a character who's like has like a reckless edge because of something to prove.
I think ultimately what they wanted to do is establish that there's conflict between these two characters. They're on opposite sides right now, but they need to come together through mutual respect and, you know, shake hands at the end of the episode and admit maybe you're right, maybe you're right. And I think that's kind of what we're ultimately getting here.
In our voicemails we recorded for the episode Saints of Imperfection, I actually talked about how I wanted, like, you know, like, I want those old episodes of Star Trek where characters just sit in a shuttle and talk for, like, the episode.
Yeah.
I guess I kind of got that this week.
Yeah.
Not the two characters, you know, that I necessarily want to see talk for, you know, an hour, but I'll take it.
We have had a couple bottle episodes so far this season. A Noble for Charon, for instance. This one, I think one of the issues that we had with at least stories coming out with the previous showrunners is like there's a lot of budget issues. So I think they're clamping down. Look, I'm not going to complain if we have bottle episodes because that means you're focusing a little bit more on the characters. And I just like Discovery having a tighter focus.
And I actually think they've done a lot of good things too with just building the ship of Discovery as like an environment I kind of care about.
Yeah.
Like I didn't think they did a very good job in season one. But if they've got these bottle episodes where they're just going to use their existing sets, I actually think it helps to build more of that familiarity and like kind of warm feelings towards the ship as an environment. Because like season one, they were struggling with that, I thought.
Okay. Mind you, I think the previous episode was pretty expensive, though, just with all that stuff on Kaminar.
True enough.
Yeah. So, Cam, lots of news to dive into. Maybe a little bit of a lightning round on that. Because we do also want to talk a little bit about some of our response from the previous episodes that we got on social media. But let's first talk about it. Official Star Trek Discovery renewed for season 3. I kind of thought, just based on the previous announcements about content coming to CBS All Access, I thought it was pretty much a guaranteed, especially when we were hearing a lot of what the producers were saying. But you pumped up for season 3 of Discovery?
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to see it clarified. You know, I was convinced by all those angry people online that Star Trek Discovery was being canceled.
It's going to be canceled after episode 1, Cam.
Yeah. It's not Star Trek.
The other news that came out, though, is Michelle Paradise, who has been helping a lot after the departure of the previous showrunners. She is officially on board for season 3 as officially co-showrunner with Alex Kurtzman. I'm kind of surprised that Alex Kurtzman is retaining at least the co-showrunner title.
Okay,
because he's going to be a very busy man overseeing the Star Trek franchise moving forward.
Yes. I have vague memories of when he was going to take over the show. There was an interview with him or something, and they asked if he would be getting a new showrunner in season 3. And he, at the time, said, probably not, but I'll have to bring someone on to help me. Mm. So that looks to be what he's stuck to. Like, I'm okay with it. If it means I just want like a unified voice over this show. That's all I ask.
I just think about like Joss Whedon when Buffy was on the air, yeah. Angel was on the air, and Firefly was on the air.
Yeah.
And like he had to have these very strong lieutenants on each one of the series.
Mm-hmm.
And it was mixed results. I thought Firefly had a great season. I thought Angel had a great season. You could see Buffy struggled in season 7 quite a bit mm-hmm. without that Joss Whedon touch. So I just hope Kurtzman is willing to find these very strong lieutenants to really guide the series. Give them, like, I just think that Discovery needs right now is just like a real strong vision. Like, I don't think they need to be like playing it safe at all. Not that I mean, like we've had decapitated baby heads. I don't think this is a show that plays it safe, but I want a really strong vision yeah. for this series and somebody who's willing to kind of just go right out there with what they want to bring to their iteration of Star Trek.
Yeah, and Alex Kurtzman, you know, I just don't know how much conflict he was having with the previous showrunners. Like, you get the sense there was a lot of drama going on behind the scenes on, well, we know in season 1, but also mm-hmm. probably early in season 2 as well.
Mm-hmm.
So if he is the one who's kind of overseeing things, just put him in charge of the show. And just let's just see what he does.
Yeah.
Let's not throw extra people between the situation.
But again, he still has to have, you know, his fingers in certain other pies with regards to the Picard series, Lower Decks, yeah. A potential Georgiou spinoff, and let's be honest, probably a Pike spinoff too, among
right.
maybe Starfleet Academy comes to fruition. There's also the Nickelodeon Kids TV show.
Yeah.
How involved is Kurtzman going to be in a lot of the day-to-day stuff with Discovery as well as all these other series? I don't know. It's tough to say.
Well, it's also tough to say just in the sense of like jockeying production times. Like he may yeah. be fine to do Discovery and then jump over and do, you know, Section 31
maybe
or something like that.
Discovery's on Mondays. Section 31 is on Tuesdays. Picard is on Wednesdays. Maybe that's it.
I don't know that he has that much going on with like Lower Decks, for example. You know, he may just be approving the pitches and, you know, overseeing the progress, sure. but I don't think he's really going to be super, super hands-on with that or the other animated show or things like that. So, you know what? I just say Discovery's their flagship show right now. I would prefer they have some secure foundation for that show as it goes forward.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think bouncing it from showrunner to showrunner is great.
Look, they like Michelle Paradise enough through the work that she did the last half of this season that yeah. they're bringing her back for season 3. Like, that can't be a bad thing.
Yeah.
So I would be more worried if they're like, well, nobody good or qualified in season 2, so we're going to have to go look for somebody else for season 3. That would be a little bit more concerning.
Yeah, exactly.
And I do like the fact that they will have some continuity leadership-wise beyond just Kurtzman.
Exactly.
Finally, you know, one Jonathan Frakes. He's a bit of a blabbermouth, which I think is just fantastic because this guy was kind of a ghost for like 20 years, and all of a sudden, like, Star Trek's back on the air.
He was doing a lot of clay pottery.
Yeah. Is that song, man.
Yeah.
But, look, he's been directing Orville, he's been directing Discovery, like, he's been doing a lot more media, and so it's great for him to kind of spill the beans, and he revealed, I don't know how many people are shocked by this, but he did confirm that he's going to be directing an episode of the Picard spinoff, which I kind of assumed would be the case, right?
I feel like he's going to probably be directing an episode of Section 31 as well. I think he's yeah. kind of in there. Stable now of directors.
What other directors from the Star Trek lineage do you think they should bring in, though, or give a shot to?
I would love to see Roxanne Dawson brought in
yeah.
and Robert Duncan McNeil. I think those two are the two that jump to mind the most.
The only issue is, you know this, like Roxanne Dawson right now is kind of like considered an A-grade
yeah.
TV director.
Yeah.
She's even doing her feature film debut. I believe she's filming it this year, so I think she's going to be a little bit tougher to come by. I think LeVar Burton would be great
sure.
as well. You know, so, but I honestly think that as far as the current Discovery producers go, they think like, yeah, we've given it to Frakes. That's our kind of, you know, legacy for the fans.
I think Burton has the best shot at being brought in.
Yeah.
Because I feel like there's so much reverence for just the TNG crew, and there's more awareness of them. Whereas I don't know that, like, Kurtzman's like, who from Voyager was directing episodes? You
yeah.
know what I mean? Like, I don't know that he's breaking down the cast list of past Star Trek series to see who directed other episodes.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, Frakes is, you know, I'm glad to see him on board, but I think Burton could have a shot as well
I think so.
At joining at some point. It just depends if he wants to.
I got to believe that.
I would think
LeVar
so, right?
Burton say yeah.
I would think so.
Yeah.
So, okay, so we also want to discuss some Red Angel theories, because we had a video that went up last week, and got actually quite popular out of kind of a surprise to us. And
I'm not surprised that I'm popular.
Well, I'm just not used to it.
I know.
But I don't really want to read all the response we got to that video, but this
is... That's rude.
I know, right? But, you know, we had sort of our fun Red Angel theories. We would have made them maybe a little more thoughtful had we known this video was going to be so popular.
Yeah, I think you and I were just kind of like...
Spitballing,
joking around mostly. Yeah, yeah. You know, it wasn't meant to be taken as seriously as it was by, like, the dozens of comments that we got on this video. But, yeah, yeah. You know.
But we thought it would be fun to just read out some of the other theories people had, because we had ours, and you can watch that video, of course, on YouTube, or just go to the Facebook page, and you can see it there as well. But we thought, you know what, let's just go through some of these theories that other people floated, and you know what, some of them maybe make sense, some of them don't, but we thought we could just kind of have fun with them and, you know, say, would this work? So let's just start with one I heard a lot of. I think this was the one people mentioned the most, and it's one that I actually began to think of before we posted the video as well, which is that it's Burnham from the future.
Sure.
And this one, to me, makes a lot of sense in the sense of we saw in Calypso, like, Discovery is stranded there in an empty ship. What if, like, Burnham is the only surviving member of that ship and she's going back in time to somehow alter the past so this doesn't happen or something like that?
Yeah. And so whenever we see, like, men from the future, they always have to signal it with, like, facial hair.
Sure.
That's gray. Do you think they give her a ponytail? Or do you think they give, like, a big scar on her face?
Oh, the scar is what you gotta have, because that shows, like, that you've been through something.
Like an eye patch, too.
The eye patch as well.
Okay.
Yeah, what do you think of the Burnham theory?
I think I could buy it. Like it wouldn't shock me if that's what it came to be. But the fact of the matter that it seems like that could be the case, I would rather just be surprised by something totally
100%,
out there.
100%. Yeah. To me, though, it's just... The thing that draws my attention to Burnham, and hopefully this is a misdirect on the role of the writers, is the fact that all these things that are being affected by red lights are somehow tied to Burnham's life.
She's been there for all of them so far.
Yeah.
Well, minus, I guess, the Spock stuff, although that does tie back to her life. So
it's not Prime Lorca is what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
We had the Iconians come up a lot.
Yeah.
Do you want to give a bit of background on the Iconians?
Not really. I don't know. It's like they're in that really weird episode of TNG when we were introduced to the Ferengi.
Yeah.
And it's a very, like, they exist 100,000 years ago in their own kind of version of the Federation. So they have, like, very strong technology, you know. So it just seems weird to me that, like, weren't they essentially frozen, like, when we encountered them in the last outpost?
I believe so.
So it wouldn't be weird that the Iconians are all of a sudden, like... Believe me, if this is just an excuse to bring back the Ferengi and have them appear
and
on
laser
Discovery
whips.
And laser whips, yeah. I am down for it. But
yeah.
I don't quite think it's the Iconians.
I'm not against it being the Iconians. I think the issue for me is more like you deliver that and you're like, guys, it's the Iconians.
And what reaction?
It is such a small... You're getting less people excited about that than the Talos IV people.
Exactly.
And so that's why I kind of question whether they would go that obscure with it. Mm-hmm. I'm not against it, but it's all execution at that point. We had Picard.
Sure,
so
I like
thought
that.
Picard flying through space.
It's going to set up the spinoff. That's all it is.
Some people thought Sisko.
Hey, I look, if you can get Avery Brooks back out of retirement...
Now, is this what happened after the fire caves? Sisko then donned red armor and flew through the galaxy.
Literally became a red angel. Yes.
We had Deanna Troi.
They didn't really explain that one, I recall from the comments.
Can you come up with any logical loopholes to even go through to justify that one?
It obviously comes from her experience with Barclay.
Yeah.
He, the engineer, has outfitted her with this future suit. And much like she helped him out with the Pathfinder project on Voyager, he's like, there's another crew that needs our help. Let's get to it, Deanna. So we're going to obviously have a... Because I think they're... Remember when Marina Sirtis was saying, like, I've got to go to Toronto for a top secret project.
Oh, my God.
And I can't talk about it with anyone.
That's
and then
right.
She's, like, taking selfies with Jonathan Frakes while she's in Toronto.
Oh, my God.
So, I don't know.
If that helmet comes off... And it is Troi. Whoever posted that comment, I bow down to you, madam or sir.
I think you should bow down to me. I'm really the one connecting all the dots here, okay?
They were ahead of you anyway. You weren't mentioning that in the video.
Okay.
And then lastly, we had a reference of Tilly. Again, Yeah. I don't know that that makes any sense with Spock.
No, I don't think it's Tilly.
Yeah. But then lastly, there was someone brought up from the original series, three alien species we saw. The Metrons from Arena, the Preservers from Paradise Syndrome, and then the Organians from Errand of Mercy, who all kind of had those very similar kind of like godlike powers.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's kind of like the Iconians. Like, again, if you write it really cool and give us something really interesting with those aliens that justifies an entire arc built around all this stuff, okay, but I think it's a tough sell.
It just seems like too much of a fan service sort of thing.
Yes.
For too many people that just won't get it.
Yeah. Unless you are really laying breadcrumbs throughout the season as to like what this species is or why it matters. Like, you could get away with that, I think, on an older Star Trek show where at the end, you know, because you have the Metrons show up at the very end of Arena and they're like, yes, you know, we are the almighty Metrons. And
are they wearing mechanized humanoid suits?
No, they were wearing, togas.
Yeah.
But, like, in those days, in 60s TV, you could do that. You could just have that alien show up at the very end and be like, we are actually, you know, mighty aliens who can control these things. And you're like, okay, sure. Like, that's a 1960s sci-fi trope, right? It's totally cool. But it would be pretty tough to pull off in Discovery in that same sort of way where you get to the end of this arc and they're like, yep, we were behind it.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay.
I think it has to be closer to the Burnham theory than anything else. It has to actually like mean something to fans
characters
at large.
Too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, it's going to be very interesting, and I guess we'll have more Red Angel watch as we go. We've got a few episodes, I'm sure, before they reveal it.
Cam, somebody also suggested Q.
Oh, that's right. That one was on my list as well. Yeah.
Okay. I don't think John DeLancey's showing up in a mechanized angel suit, although it could be a callback to that World War III narcotic suit that he wore in Encounter at Farpoint.
Do you think they're going to bring some sort of Q species into Discovery at some point?
I hope not. I just, you know, I think we struck gold with John DeLancey. I'm not super interested in those kind of omnipresent sort of they can manifest sort of anything sort of species.
Sure.
It's just kind of like, it takes kind of the stakes out of it. Let me ask you this though. Do you think John DeLancey kind of has to at least make one appearance in the Picard spinoff?
Yes.
Like
he has to. Like to me, in my mind, that is a very, very tough thing to not do.
It just feels as if, you know, 25 years after All Good Things, and I think honestly, we've got to do kind of a 25th anniversary of Next Generation's finale some way. We've already done a review of that episode, but I think we'll address the finale.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe with a review of that Deep Space Nine documentary that might one day come out. Who knows?
Yeah.
But
on the 50th anniversary of Deep Space Nine.
It's been 25 years since we saw Picard and Q.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were saying that this is still going to be kind of a dance that would go on for a long time. We got closure. But I wouldn't mind like one little dance routine between the two of them. Just even if it's one episode, I'm down for it.
What do you think is more important to the character of Picard and his ongoing journey? A reunion with Q or a reunion with the previous cast of TNG?
So I think thematically,
mm-hmm.
the reunion with Q.
Yeah.
I think on a more visceral level in which something that aligns with Picard's journey to develop a family of his own, I think it has to be the TNG cast.
Right.
And ultimately, I do need to lean towards the TNG cast, though, because I think the very important thing about this man, he's a man without a family, but it was something that he came to grips with. He danced around as well. I'm using the word dance quite a bit.
There's a lot of dancing going on.
You can
this
see
week.
Me like grooving, doing the Charleston right now as I record. But I think ultimately we need to establish how important family is to him, and it's a makeshift family. Because like the way that we left Robert and Renee,
right. Yeah,
it's just brutal.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's where his legacy ultimately is going to be, with the impact that he has on these very important, you know, officers in his life.
He has to have some sort of connections. It'd be pretty weird if the show was just like Picard adrift with like no one close to him again.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of where he was at the start of TNG. But then we saw by the end, he's sitting down at the table and they seem like a pretty tight unit through the movies as well. It'd be pretty weird if Picard is just like by himself now. And he's like, oh yeah, that was in the past.
He's just hanging out with the Traveler.
That's his only companion.
Forget Q, the traveler. Yeah. That's where it's at.
He might come back.
He always comes back.
Let's ask Eric Muniak at the next convention if he'd be willing to appear again on the Star Trek Picard spinoff.
Playing interdimensional jazz.
I love it. Oh. With those fingers on the sax. Look up Traveler's Hands for anybody that does not get the reference.
I don't want to know what you're going to get on that Google search. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. We'll have a video up, of course. And next week, of course, we'll have a review of the next episode of Discovery, where hopefully we get a little more character out of Spock.
Less talk, more Spock.
That's right. Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam. V is in Violations of Causality. Smith.
Are you saving Vina for next week?
I am.
Oh, it's sorry to ruin that.
I have used Vina so many times in the past that, yeah. You know, I got to mix it up.
Feel free to edit that out if it ruins it for fans.
Yeah, sure.
I know our fans are just going to be brokenhearted. Yeah. And by fans, I should say people that are willing to listen to this show.
That's right.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P-O-R-T. Take me to Talos 4. O-N.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.